You know, Irving Berlin summed it all up when he said there's no business like show business.
There goes the Daverhood.
The guy David Lefkowitz is here. He's a Long Island arts guy. He's got his own radio show.
Greetings from Long Island, where every highway is a sunrise. It's time for Dave's Gone By, an hour of comedy, talk, and music brought to you by Total Theater, with your host, Dave Lefkowitz. You've never heard anything like it, so sit back, relax, squeal if you must. Here's the host of Dave's Gone By, Dave!
Tropical hot dog night! I shoot flamingos in a fruit fight!
Well, there goes the Daverhood. Welcome, everybody. Welcome on this very, very, very cold December 9th, 2009, to the 322nd episode of Dave's Gone By. We're calling it Eine Kleine Nachman. Actually, Nachman, I should say. For our special guest, Gerald Nachman. I'll tell you about him in a little bit. But, oh my gosh, I'm in the basement recording this right now. You know, I'm living in northern Colorado these days, and it's wonderful here, and we have a beautiful late summer and a very nice early fall, and then, you know, we had a snowstorm in October, which was, okay, a little early for these kinds of things, and then more bad weather in November around Thanksgiving time, but I'm used to that. Because even back when I was living in New York, Thanksgiving was that turning point. The weather would still be kind of nice, and you'd have Indian summer days and 60 or 70 degrees. And then Thanksgiving weekend, the snain came, and the heavy, dark rain, and it was really chilly and damp and awful. And you knew that, yeah, there'd be periodic good days here and there, but fall was over and winter was on its way pretty much from then until March. You know, you were stuck with a bad weather. Well, I've got to say, everything they told me about Colorado before we moved here is true. It is colder, and you do get a lot more snow. We're already into past our third snowstorm of the season here, and it's not even winter. We had snow this weekend, literally, that started on Saturday morning, and didn't quite 100% stop until Monday night. Now, most of it was flurries, and through it all, I don't think we even got a foot. But when it snows for more than 48 hours at a time, you really get the sense that you are north and west and high up and cold. And woke up this morning, put on the TV, and saw that the weather people were saying that with the wind chill factor before the sun went up in northern Colorado where we are, the temperature that you would feel in your bones and on your skin was 22 degrees below zero. 22 below zero. And I have to say, when I was living in New York, and if I had heard that number, my eyes would have boggled. It wouldn't have been possible for me to comprehend how you could even function in that kind of thing. You would have to bundle up in mucklucks and furs. And you wouldn't even have a fur. You'd have to get an actual live animal, like a buffalo, to drape around you and to breathe on your head just so you have some warmth around your body. But I guess what the other thing that they said about Colorado is also true, that because it's much, much less damp, you don't feel the cold quite the same. You certainly, any time it goes under zero, you feel the cold. But 22 below here is probably the feeling of like 5 below in New York. Not that that's anything to sneeze at, especially since if you sneeze, it'll come out as crystals. But I was all excited about moving to Colorado, and the weather was so gorgeous here for a couple of weeks when we first got here, that I was like, hey, you know, what am I saying? There's nothing wrong with the weather in Colorado. You got the mountains and so much sunshine, and it's really neat. Okay, I understand now. It gets cold. It gets snowy. It's going to be a long winter, but at least we really still do get the sunshine. And even though it's I think about 15 degrees outside right now, there's melting going on because the sun is so powerful. And you look up at the sky and you still look up at the mountains and you go, okay, you know, you take with the good with the bad, and the good and the bad kind of come simultaneously here, as opposed to New York, where, you know, it's bad, 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 oh, good, bad, 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 oh, good. Maybe I won't feel like that if we're here a few years, but the charm is still on the rose. The bloom is still there, for now. For now. Anyway, speaking of now, we have to get to the show that we're about to do. It's called Dave's Gone By. I've been doing it since October of 2002, and as I said, we're on to our 322nd episode here. This is going to be such a cool one, because I've got someone who has pretty much exactly the same interests as I do. And since this show is all about me, well, that's fine. His name is Gerald Nachman, and he wrote for both the New York Post and the Daily News. He was a theater critic for a while. He also wrote a humor column for a long time. And dig this. The man has written three books, okay? One book was about stand-up comedy. It was called Seriously Funny. Another book was about his growing up and being raised on radio, a.k.a. the so-called golden age of radio, where you tuned in for The Shadow and Jack Benny and Fred Allen and Fibber McGee and Molly and things like that. So, okay, he loves stand-up comedy, and he loves radio, and now he's written a brand new book called Right Here on Our Stage Tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Now, I can't say that I'm a huge Ed Sullivan fan. It was before my time. But still, the idea of this love of popular culture, entertainment, and a higher level of it, and also the way America changed in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that's just fascinating to me. So I'm thrilled to be talking to Gerald Nachman just a little bit, you know, actually a couple of minutes from now. He'll be on this episode of Dave's Gone By. So don't miss it. If you were part of that period watching Ed Sullivan on Sunday nights, I guess it was, or if you love stand-up comedy and hearing about comedians or the radio, check him out. It's going to be great. Also, unfortunately, we're not going to have time to do Inside Broadway this week. I wish we could, but I think we're going to spend some extra time with Gerald, and I wanted to play some music on this one because just a couple of days ago, we lost the last Clancy brother. Liam Clancy died, I think it was December 4th, of a lung ailment, and he wasn't that old, unfortunately, but he contributed so much to modern popular and Irish folk music, and certainly to and through the great, great Clancy brothers. So I want to do a proper tribute to him and also have everybody get a chance to hear him sing, because it was really, really special. So that's on Dave's Gone By tonight, which is brought to you by Performing Arts Insider, the Bible of Broadway since 1944. It's about 67 years old now, if I'm doing my math right, which I may not be. But you can find out a lot more information about it at performingartsinsider.com. And go to davesgoneby.org to find out how you, as a Dave's Gone By listener, can get a very special subscription rate to Performing Arts Insider. This program is also brought to you by Hewlett Minuteman Press, the Copy Kings of Broadway, located at 1315 Broadway in Hewlett, Long Island, right opposite the big Lohman store there. And every Dave's Gone By listener, you go in there, you get 10% off every job, big or small, at Hewlett Minuteman Press. Programs are also brought to you by Fancy Schmancy Balloons for all your party decorating needs. Call Jeff at 516-797-3229. That's 516-797-3229. It's not just balloons. Shouldn't your party be a fancy schmancy event? Well, it's time to get the main event underway. This episode of Dave's Gone By. Put on your parkas, put on your gloves, and get ready for some fun chat with Gerald Nachman and some wonderful music from the Clancy brothers. Do not go away.
Moby Dick, Ulysses, War and Peace, the Bible. Big freaking deal. If you want to read a real book, a funny book, try Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, a collection of comedies by Dave Lefkowitz, me, the host of Dave's Gone By. Each play is stage-tested and relatively safe for public consumption. Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World, available from Holvo Books on the Dave's Gone By website. It's the great American something.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, from New York, The Ed Sullivan Show. And now, here he is, live from New York, Ed Sullivan.
Now, here's one of the greatest thrills we've ever had on our stage.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. It's rare for me to find someone who writes a book about something that I'm really, really interested, that I run into and can contact. It's even rarer when there's somebody who's written three books, all about different topics that, you know, if I had the time, the energy, and the brilliance to do it, would have done them myself. So this man has written a book about stand-up comedy. He's also written a book about growing up with old-time radio, so he loves radio very much. And now he's written a book about the culture of America through the 50s and 60s, through the television of the time, and most specifically, through Ed Sullivan. To have those kinds of interests, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to talk to this particular person, especially since he's also been a theater critic and a journalist and a humorist. It's like if you took all the things that I put after my name, you could put them right after his, only he does them more prolifically and probably better. His name is Gerald Nachman, and he's with us on Dave's Gone By in the neighborhood. Welcome, Gerald.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate you being here. I appreciate me being here, you being here, too.
Well, yeah, it's great. I mean, the amazing thing is, when I saw your name and you had written the Ed Sullivan book and these other books, your name started to ring bells because you were a New York columnist and writer and critic for quite a few years.
Yeah, I was. I was, 100 years ago, I was at the old New York Post as a feature writer and a celebrity profiler, and then more recently, meaning 30 years ago, I was at the 35 years, I guess, I was at the New York Daily News, and I wrote a humor column for 7 years, for the New York Daily News.
No, okay, let's backtrack already to the New York Post, because the way we think of the New York Post now is this incredibly right-wingy Republican rag.
Right.
Wasn't it liberal when you were writing for it?
It was New York's most liberal paper, and I wasn't quite aware of that at the time. I'm from California. I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland, actually, and I knew almost nothing about the New York Post, but I wanted to go to New York, so I left San Jose, where I was writing a TV and humor column, and just left to quit and went back to New York, because I always had a New York bug. I wanted to see what New York was all about, so I went back there when I was about 24, and it's a roundabout story, but I ended up at the New York Post because a friend of mine who was in New York told me that it was the best paper for writers, and it really was a good writer's paper. They let you alone, and gave you kind of a lot of freedom. But they were very glamorous days for me, being in New York and young and all that. And it's the best time to go to New York is when you're young.
Well, let me ask a quick question, a couple of things. First of all, you left the San Jose paper, a job that you've gotten right out of college. I mean, nobody gets that lucky. Well, I mean, you're obviously good, but the fact is, But you went to New York before you had the job waiting for you at the Post? You just figured, I'm going to go and see what happens?
Yeah, actually, to backtrack one little step,
sure.
I was actually in college when I got the job at the San Jose Mercury. I was writing a humor column in the college paper, and I got hired out of that, and I was my senior year, and I was writing a TV column, which was a huge break for a fairly big paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went back to New York just because I had this thing about New York. I wanted to see what it was all about. I'd read about it. It had, you know, terrific lore and appeal and glamour and everything else, and I didn't want to stay in San Jose forever. My family was somewhat appalled because they thought, you know, you've got a great job on a good paper, and why give that up? And I couldn't argue with that, except...
You have a Jewish family, I can tell.
But I had this wanderlust, and I wanted to go to New York, and as I said, I had to see what it was all about. You know, it's a way to test yourself, and I'd been pretty successful, and I was pretty young, so I thought, well, I'll see if my luck holds out, and eventually it did. But I didn't. I started as a summer intern at the old liberal New York Post, and they didn't keep me because I had Because they had me doing newspaper, hard news, and I'm a terrible reporter at that. I love feature writing and column writing and reviewing.
But you were able to jump to the Daily News after a certain point.
Well, I went back and forth. I left the New York Post, got married, I came back to San Francisco Bay Area, got a job at the Oakland Tribune, in between the two New York papers. I was a theater and film critic at the Oakland Tribune for 4.5 years. Then I wanted to go back to New York again, and so my wife and I went back to New York in 72, and I caught on at the New York Daily News fairly quickly, and I was a feature writer for a while, and then I asked them if I could do a humor column, because that was my ultimate goal always. And I talked them into it, and I did that for 7 years.
And then
that was in the 70s.
Right, and then they decided, or you decided, that was enough.
Yeah, I had enough in New York. I kind of wanted to go back. I don't know. That's one of those crossroad decisions. You always wonder, you know, how would it have been if I'd stayed. And I actually talked to the editor at the New York Daily News into letting me continue writing my columns from San Francisco. It kind of involved my wife wanted to move back here, and I'd lived there, you know, 7 years, and that's a long time. And I always say I never realized what a California guy I was until I lived in New York. I love New York. I just got back from there. I love going once a year for, you know, a couple of weeks, and I get it out of my system, and I come back to reality.
That's what people from New York say when they go out to the coast.
Bay Area, although San Francisco's another unreal place.
Well, yeah. What is the difference between writing for an East Coast paper and a West Coast paper?
For me, you know, I just try to do my best, and maybe that's a little too flippant answer. There is a difference, although, so you try your hardest wherever you are, you know, whether it's Podunk or New York City, and although the competition is a little stiffer in New York, there's no question about it. I think you tend to play over your head a little bit, as they say in sports. And I think you write at the very, very top of your skill, because you have to compete. So it's a little faster game. There's no question about it.
And now, are you doing a blog for somewhere? Are you with a paper now, or?
No, I left the San Francisco Chronicle in 1993, 16 years ago, and I've been writing these three books that you mentioned since then. And I do write for a website. I don't have a blog. I do write for a website called thecolumnist.com, and I was one of the four co-founders of it 10 years ago, and I write for them occasionally.
Now, tell us just a little bit about thecolumnists.com. It's basically an aggregate of people who...
Yeah, it's about entertainment, the arts, sports, anything we want to write about. It's made up of a conglomeration of people that the four founders knew, and then it's since branched out. And so when I have something I want to get off my chest, or when I can't sell it to someone else, it will land on thecolumnist.com. And I've written, you know, probably a couple hundred pieces for them.
Well, here's
you can go there and archive some of my stuff if anyone's interested.
So here's the thing. I mean, you're a person like so many of my colleagues over the past few years. I mean, you have been in the newspaper and journalism business for a long time, and often made the decision to leave a major paper when it just felt like time. But so many of my colleagues are in a situation where they're downsized, or they've gone from being a full-time person to being, I guess, adjunct would be almost the word for it, or you know, doing stuff on spec. How does a website like The Columnist make a go of it? Where's the money from?
There is no money. There is no money. It's totally money. Well, we don't lose money, but the guy that runs it has, you know, he's put in a little of his money just to maintain the site. But
that's a couple of $100. You know, that's,
no ads. Yeah. Although he's looked into that possibility of getting ads for it. But that's, you need somebody to work at that full time. I don't understand how all that stuff works. So I'm totally a print guy, meaning pen, you know. Paper and ink.
No, I was just sort of hoping that...
I don't believe there's anybody out there reading this stuff, so... and, you know, yeah, I just don't get any feedback from it, and if I write something that's in a newspaper or magazine, I usually get some feedback, and so it's writing on air to me, and it's you know, you have to do it because that's the new world, but it's not my preference at all. I'd much rather write for a newspaper or magazine.
Well, speaking of writers, one thing that did tickle me, I guess, either when you were on one of the major papers, you served on the committee that decided the Pulitzer Prize for a play.
For drama, yeah. I got chosen because somebody I knew was on it, and they suggested that they needed a representative from the West Coast.
When you were on the Pulitzer Committee, what year was that, and
okay.
What was the play? What did you guys select?
Well, it's a play that hasn't been done very much. It was called, I think it was like 69 or something like that. It was a long time ago. And it was a great honor, to be sure. You know, you fly back to New York and you meet in a room and you read or see the plays. And it was a thing called the Kentucky Cycle.
Oh, wait, that wasn't that long ago. It wasn't 69. Kentucky Cycle was...
79? I don't know, maybe it's 79.
Well, it was actually the year just before, I think, Angels in America. It was probably... almost 89, because they did that on
board. But it was a long, it's like a 7-hour thing.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
go
yeah.
And you take a lunch break, or I mean a dinner break, and it was quite a good play considering how long it was, and I have very little, I get impatient easily, but I was held by it. It's a good play, but it takes a lot, big cast, and it's very, complicated to produce because it's a long, long play.
Yeah, no, I remember. They did it on, it came to Broadway at around the same time Angels in America did.
That's and, right. After and, it won the right. Pulitzer, it came to Broadway. I think it was done in L.A. or originally at the Arlington Theater.
Talking about writing again, one of your books was about stand-up comedy.
Seriously funny.
Mm-hmm.
The subtitle is The Rebel Comedians of the 1950s and 60s. So it's not just about stand-up comedians. It's about a very specific era. And, you know, many of them were stand-ups, but I also dealt with TV comedians and radio comedians, Bob and Ray and, you know, Gene Shepherd and people like that. Comedians who came along in that era, starting with Mort Saul and ending with Phyllis Diller, were sort of making satirical social commentary, more than just, you know, Henny Youngman one-liners. So it was a very different kind of comedy, and nobody had written a book about that then, and I don't know, I think there have been a couple of similar books since then, but I think mine is the most comprehensive. I like to think that anyway.
So who was the best interview that you had?
Best interview.
I mean, you talk to people like Steve Allen, Woody Allen, Jonathan Winters.
I was just amazed. I think I have to say Mike Nichols, who got me, who was, you know, he and Elaine May had a famous comedy team in the early 60s called Nichols and May. Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And he gave me an hour and 45 minutes, which was quite amazing. And he's a busy guy still. And he was very honest, but I liked all of them that I got to. I didn't think I'd get to Woody Allen, and you know, they promised me 20 minutes, and I thought, oh, geez, I can barely, you know, clear my throat in 20 minutes, so, but he ended up giving me 45 minutes, and he was a very good interview, and very businesslike. He's not very personable, but he answered honestly, and, you know, gave me candid answers, and I liked Jonathan Winters, who was kind of the most, I connected best with, even though, I talked to him at his home outside Santa Barbara, and he asked me to go to lunch with him. He's the only comedian who did that, and so I liked him for that. And he was also very, very open and honest, and so we had lunch in town, and that was memorable for that reason.
Was there anything that you gained by doing that book that you kind of didn't know going in? In other words, along the span of the late 50s, early 60s, that America was changing, the world was changing, and comedy was part of both the forefront and reflecting that. But what did you learn about comedy from doing the book?
I don't know, probably a whole lot, because I dealt with about 20 comedians, and their lives are very complicated, their ups and downs, and many of them, you know, had a huge career and then went into a slide, like Mort Saul, and many of them, almost all of them actually, there were a few that went into TV and did incredibly well, Bill Cosby and Bob Newhart specifically, But guys like Saul and even Shelley Berman had a long period when he wasn't very popular anymore.
Well, that's interesting.
You know, that's the thing, you explode and then, you know, then people get used to you or something happens and you screw up your career somehow or your life takes a bad turn. And so that happened with a lot of these people.
Because you would figure
various ways. Yeah.
You would figure that someone like Saul, who was doing topical material before, he would have rode the wave or ridden the wave. Whereas, I guess, as opposed to, say, a Shelley Berman, who might have been lumped in with more of the Catskill-y sort of comics because he wasn't political.
Well, he wasn't Catskill at all. He was just doing kind of neurotic comedy. He was kind of a very personal kind of comedy. It was very different. And Saul had this huge burst of excitement and was huge. And then he got waylaid because he got involved in the investigation of the Kennedy assassination.
He
started, boring audiences by talking about conspiracy theories and all that. And he never got his traction back all the way, a little bit. And then he was doing political comedy. He was the only one really doing political humor, strictly political humor, at a time, and nobody else was. And now everybody is doing it. You know, Jon Stewart, Bill Maher, and everybody's doing it. It's now kind of boring. I wish they'd get back to, you know, nonsense comedy, or comedy again, because they've sort of exhausted it. And but Saul was incredibly sharp, incredibly fast, lightning fast guy. He's kind of a hero of mine. But
I have heard that he's not the nicest person.
He's a very difficult guy. He can be very nice, and he can be, kind of prickly, and he doesn't suffer fools gladly, and he's got a huge ego, and he will admit all of this, by the way, which is kind of a saving grace with people who will admit to their flaws. He knows this, and he kind of jokes about it, and he wouldn't even talk to me. I'd interviewed him over the years two or three times and reviewed him always very favorably, because he's a kind of a hero of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't want to talk to me, and I was just so disappointed and just kind of aghast at that, because we had a good relationship. He says, because it's his vanity, and he says, I don't want to be in that book with all those other guys, because he considers himself better than almost everybody.
Oh,
and then later, though, we did a panel in L.A. He and Tom Smothers, and I was a moderator. He came and after he read the chapter I did on him in the book, and he's actually on the cover of the book, which I guess didn't hurt. He was apologetic, apologizing all over himself. I should have talked to you. I don't know what's wrong with me, and blah blah blah. So he's really kind of a good guy, but he's a difficult guy.
Did you get the feeling when you were interviewing all these people, the old cliche that most of them are unhappy people?
Not most, but some are. There's no question about it. Jonathan Winters had a dreadful childhood. Saul had a very good childhood. Newhart had a normal childhood. Shelley Berman had a pretty normal childhood. Mike Nichols had an unhappy childhood. If you can go down the list, and it's sort of evenly divided. That's kind of a myth that they all had unhappy childhoods. I don't think that's quite true.
But some
of them did. A lot of dentists probably had unhappy childhoods.
I didn't even mean unhappy childhood. I mean, you can have a perfectly normal or even healthy, happy childhood and still come out a pretty mixed up, screwed up, unhappy person.
I think that's true. You can. Comedians are different. You know, they're very different kinds of people. They see the world in a very skewed way, which, if they're any good, is what makes them funny.
Old episodes of Dave's Gone By don't die. They just get archived on CD and on the internet. They're on CD for just $10, including shipping and handling, makes a wonderful gift. But if you just want to listen on your computer, you can go to davesgoneby.org and see all the archives and listen to them free anytime at all, including a list of what's been on every episode of Dave's Gone By. So go to davesgoneby.org for all the information you need to know to hear me on CD. What's black and white and red all over? Photocopies made at Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy kings of Broadway. Any job that you have, including black and white copies, and they've got a brand new color copier, great quality, good prices, wonderful family that has owned Hewlett Minuteman Press since the 1970s. So check them out, 516-569-5577, Hewlett Minuteman Press. They're the kings.
Ladies and gentlemen, sitting here with me on our stage is one of the great talents of the theater, one of the great human beings of theater. Now that the curtain is open...
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and we are speaking with, a man with so many acronyms after his name, journalist, writer, and appreciator. I don't know why I said acronyms, that's the wrong word, but he's an appreciator of the things that not only I, but I think we all should appreciate. Comedy, radio entertainment, humor. He's been a humorist for so many years, and we're talking with him. We were talking about stand-up comedy. Now let's talk about a broader spectrum of entertainment, because Gerald Nachman has written a book called Right Here on Our Stage. Actually, can you say it like Ed Sullivan would?
I don't do a very good imitation. Right Here on Our Stage Tonight.
Not bad.
That's about as good as I can do.
Ed Sullivan's America. It's a publication by University of California Press. Ooh. But please, folks, do not think that this is some kind of academic treatise or journal. I've started reading the book, and you are a really good writer.
Thank you very much.
And I don't say this to BS or
you can say it for any reason. Thank you, Dave.
But I can tell... I can see how you could have written a column like several times a week and just put these books out, because you just have a marvelous flowing style that gets all the facts in, but also is very, very readable.
Well, that's the goal, and that's the trick, is to make it informative but not academic, as you say, and you have to entertain the folks, so you try to be as amusing as you can and still... you know, be informative. So it's a balance, and that's the challenge of a book like this.
Now, in investigating and researching Ed Sullivan, what are some of the things that you wouldn't expect to come out of his life and career?
Well, let's see. He was a bit of a womanizer. I didn't know about that. He was kind of a wooden, frozen, phrase stiff on TV, as everyone remembers. But
he looked like a bloodhound. Yeah.
But what's that?
And he kind of looked like a bloodhound.
Yeah, sort of. He was, but in his youth, we remember, maybe you remember him because you were just a kid. He was like in the 60s then, but in his youth, in the 30s, he was kind of a good-looking guy. He'd been a jock, and he was, he's kind of a charming guy. He could be, he could also be hot-headed and temperamental and difficult, like all these guys, But he was women found him attractive, and so that was kind of new. And then I found out about his boyhood. He had a kind of a difficult boyhood. People don't know much about it, but everything in his past led up inexorably to the TV show. He was an athlete, and then he became a sports columnist, and then he became a Broadway gossip columnist, talking about, you know. That's a category that doesn't even exist anymore. He worked for a lot of New York newspapers, and finally wound up emceeing some stage shows in New York, and out of that came the TV show in 1948, in really the first year of television.
One of the interesting things, you mentioned the whole sports thing that people might not remember, and you make it clear early in the book that personally he was awed by talent and celebrity, but he felt a little bit more comfortable with sports figures, and
that was surprising to me. Speaking of surprising things, that he didn't mix very much with performers. He was very much at ease with athletes. Sports was always his first love, and he used to put a lot of athletes on his show. He would either introduce them in the audience or have them, like Jackie Robinson or someone, come up on stage, or Rocky Marciano, and kind of spar with him for fun, or talk about hitting with Jackie Robinson, because he loved athletes, and he mixed easily with them. He was in awe of performers and talent, but he did not feel really much at home with them. He only, as far as I could track down, he only had one really close friend who was in show business, an older singer named Jerry Vale.
Oh, yeah.
An Italian singer.
I should mention I'm 45 years old, so you know, when you say people like Jerry Vale, I do know who they are.
Do you know the name? Well, I always have to be aware that people, you know, 20 and 30 are maybe not aware of that. But he sang a lot of Italian songs. He's still around.
Now, one of the other things you mentioned, and I forget their names, but that he had quote-unquote feuds of some sort with a few people. Now, most of us think in terms of maybe just one with Jackie Mason, because they had that misunderstanding.
Yeah, that's the most famous one because of the finger incident, which everyone wants to know about. And I did interview Jackie Mason. I should say I interviewed 60 performers for this book, there have been a couple, three other books on Ed Sullivan written a long time ago, and none of them, oddly to me, interviewed any of the performers. I wanted to tell about what the show was like kind of from the inside out, and the only way to do this is to talk to people who actually played the show, and many of them played it very many, multiple times. So I talked to Mason about the finger incident where Sullivan thought Mason was flipping him off on camera. He wasn't. He was making fun of Sullivan was giving him the 1 minute sign.
Right.
He had to cut his routine, and Sullivan drove comedians crazy because he was always trying to get them to cut their routines because, you know, the show was live almost the entire run of 23 years. So that's hard to do, to fit in 7 or 8
sure.
acts and make it come out on time. So he would always go after the comedians because he felt it was easier to cut jokes than it was to cut a song in half. He couldn't do that. But comedy acts are very carefully structured, and a joke in the first part may pay off later, and you just simply can't cut one or two jokes that easily with most comedians. So Mason felt it's kind of complicated. The studio audience was watching Ed Sullivan giving the 1 minute sign to Mason. As a result, they weren't responding, and Mason told me he was afraid the home audience, the viewers, would think he was dying. So he started making fun of that. He said, a finger for you, and a finger for you, and a finger for you. And Sullivan was offended. He thought he was being flipped off.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Sullivan was just Mason was just trying to be funny and trying to salvage the moment. But Sullivan was easily offended, had a thin skin. He didn't like to be crossed, and he felt that the Mason was kind of making fun of him. And so he was very, very angry. Almost talked to a guy backstage and said he wanted to punch him out. But so he wouldn't have him back on the show for many years.
But did Mason ever get back on the Sullivan Show?
Yeah, they ran into each other in an airport or somewhere, and they made up. Sullivan was always sorry for some of the feuds he started. He was, as I say, he was kind of a volatile Irishman, and he would blow up, and then it would die, then it would subside very quickly. And he said, "I always went around apologizing afterwards." So he could be a good guy, and he just had a. He was just kind of hot-headed, and he made up with Jackie Mason and invited him back on the show, but only once. And Mason told me he thought that was because Sullivan was trying to avoid a lawsuit, because Mason's career had been severely hurt by not being asked back on Sullivan's show, and really not on many TV shows after that, because it was, you know, it was front page stories around the country for a while. And Mason was going to sue him, and never happened. The judge threw the case out, but it did hurt his career for a while. He worked, but he never worked at TV for many years.
Who are some of the other feudies?
Well, Jack Parr was the other major one. Jack Parr was host of the Tonight Show for, you know, many years, and it was over how much they were paying performers. So he said, if a performer who appears on my show goes on Parr's show and performs, he won't be asked back. If he goes on just to talk, then he didn't have any problem with that. So performers were sort of torn because they wanted to be on both shows and didn't know what to do. And then Parr invited Sullivan on his show to have a debate about it. And there was, it was on the cover of Life magazine. It was a big, big deal.
Oh, yeah.
And it never happened because one of them or both of them kind of, I think Parr kind of chickened out because he changed the rules. He wanted to have a studio audience, and Sullivan said, you know, nothing doing that was part of the agreement, no audience. Because Parr knew how to play his audience beautifully and would get all the people, you know, cheering him and booing Sullivan. And Sullivan was smart enough not to go on in that circumstance. So the thing never happened.
Huh.
But that was a big feud.
Now, when Sullivan Show ended in 1971. It doesn't feel like it was that long ago, but I guess it was.
Well, it, almost 40 years ago, yeah. 1971, yeah.
I thought he was on sort of more into the 70s. Was it his decision, or was it a network decision, or was it both?
No, not his decision at all. He was really floored by his decision, because the show had run, it was a habit, it was a national habit, it ran 23 years. It had waned a little, and then it got revived by the Beatles in 64, and then it had a new life in the rock and roll era, but as I go into in the book, it kind of ended up hurting the show in a way, because he lost some of his older core audience and rock acts. A lot of rock acts didn't want to play the Sullivan Show after a while, so he kind of lost touch. And then it was ratings also. It's always ratings. So he was kind of losing some of the steam. I mean the show wasn't. And he was getting older. He was approaching 70, and he was kind of losing a little bit. He had a little bit of early Alzheimer's. His daughter told me. And he was very forgetful, and he sort of lost track, lost some traction.
Sure.
And the show just kind of was canceled but it went out. It had a lot of good company. Beverly Hillbillies was canceled, Green Acres, Lassie, The Andy Griffith Show, a lot of major shows where they just, CBS just cleaned house. They had a new president who wanted more hipper, sharper shows on than those.
I'm curious what the lineup was on CBS in 1971-72. What replaced all these? Not that these were all such wonderful shows. I mean,
Well, they brought in some better shows like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, which was a little more contemporary. It wasn't like, it wasn't no something.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
It wasn't like Green Acres and more, some of those shows. Columbo, I think, was on.
Oh.
And I can't think of any others that are in the book, but they did. But the irony is they replaced the Unsullivan Show with a thing called CBS Sunday Night Movie, which is just old movies. So they really weren't. They were drawing on the same audience in a way.
Huh. And how much longer did Sullivan live after 71? What did he do?
A couple of years. He died in 73.
Oh, wow.
72 years old. He died in 73. His wife had died the year before. So he lost his show, and then he lost his wife, and he was really kind of a hollowed out guy by then. And the show was his whole show, and his wife were the two centers of his life. So he was just, and then he had a terrible ulcer most of his life, which developed into cancer, and then he died.
Now, before I let you go, Gerald Nachman, and it's been, as I figured it would be so much fun to be talking about your journalism career and also your book about comedians, and now your book about Ed Sullivan, but you also wrote a book about something that, for obvious reasons, I'm very close to in my heart. Growing up on radio.
Oh yeah.
I was very lucky
to come to be around when radio was in its heyday. It was in my bones, really, and it was really the easiest book for me to write. Although I did a lot of research on it as well, and talked to a lot of old time radio people who are still around. Sound effects people and the actors, some of the writers and stuff. They were still around when I wrote it, which was about 10 years ago. So that was a lot of fun to write. That was the closest to my heart of all these.
Sure.
That's called Race on Radio. And I talked about the Lone Ranger and, so many shows.
Well, Fibber, Mickey, and Molly and The Dark Shadow.
Shadow, the Lone Ranger, and all the Westerns, the Texas shows, quiz shows, every genre, comedy shows, Jack Benny Show and Burt and Allen Show, and it was a lot of fun to write.
What I don't understand, I mean, I guess there are logical explanations for this, but when radio came along, the theater didn't die. When TV came along, the movies didn't die. They took a hit, but movies are still a huge, huge business. Why did radio never really come back?
That's one of the great imponderables and a very, very sad topic, because it could very easily come back overnight. It's a very cheap form. You just need some microphones and scripts and actors stand around. You don't need sets, costumes, or anything like that. It's because people who run radio networks and stations are, you know, want to go for something even cheaper, which is just to have, you know, music, news, and sports, which is the easiest way to go and the cheapest. And nobody has tried to bring it back. Yeah, there are a few shows, you know, on NPR that are like it. Most obviously the Garrison Keillor show,
right?
Prairie Home Companion, and there's a show like Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and some of those shows. So there's a handful that are like the old radio shows, but it's nothing like it was with Amos and Andy and Cisco Kid, and you know, it was a rich period.
The old joke about well, it was radio, and yet people would sit around in the living room and they would look at the radio.
Yeah, I know.
But I understand that. Because
yeah.
It tells
us. You were kind of imagining the people inside the radio performing. You know, it was nothing else to look at. And but it was because it was all in your head. I mean, that's
right.
It's like in the book, I point out that it's the closest thing to reading, where you imagine the characters based on their voices and on the situation. And in that sense, it's the most intimate form of any kind of performance that I can think of. And it, too, was live for many, many years. And it really just held you fascinated. And I put in 3-4 hours a day listening to it after school. You'd have Serial, Superman, and Batman, and, you know, Green Hornet and all that. And then after dinner, you immediately go to my room and start listening to the radio until I had to turn my light off. And then I listened to it under the covers. A lot of us did that, too.
What was your favorite show?
I like the show which old radio fans will remember fondly. Most people haven't heard of, called The Great Gildersleeve, which was it was a sitcom, and it was just about a guy who had a niece and a nephew, and he was trying to raise them, and it was more real than a lot of the other shows. Also, the Jack Benny show was, you know, probably the best remembered and probably best written of all the shows, and those shows still hold up, and I should say you can still order all these shows. There's a company called Radio Spirits, and you can order tapes of any of these shows. It's still available, and people that don't know about it are amazed at how good they are, and that they, and A, they are available, and B, how many of them hold up. Not all of them, for sure.
Right.
Some of them are a little tinny and cheesy sounding now, but a lot of the comedy shows do. The Edgar Bergen, Charlie McCarthy show does. Burns and Allen, Jack Benny, and the Great Gildersleeve that I just mentioned, they all hold up. And there's just, you know, there's thousands. I have probably 1,000 show tapes in my basement right now.
Well, you've got to start transferring them to CD or to MP3s, you know, before those. If they're on ferrous oxide tape, they won't be around for
a
while.
Oh, yeah, they're also DVDs. CDs.
Oh, okay.
Also CDs. Oh, for sure. You can go to Borders. They used to be able to, and they have box sets of a lot of these shows.
True.
But they're really worth investigating because it's a whole new form, and you'll be transfixed if you don't have any memory of old radio. And if you do, then you'll be transported.
Now, let me ask... you've written the Ed Sullivan book, that is your most recent, called Right Here on Our Stage Tonight. Oh, I can't, I don't even, not even going to try to imitate Ed Sullivan or Ed Sullivan's
something
America.
Something he said every two or three times during the show.
But you've written it, and since you're a writer, that means you're already thinking about your next project, which will be?
Well, the next thing I think I'm going to write about is nothing to do with, you know, these three books took a lot out of me in terms of research. There's a lot of work and a lot of time, and I want to write a book, a humor book. I want to get back to humor again. I'm writing a humor book about getting older, which I'm living with every day, and everybody says, what's so funny about that? But there are funny things to write about, and so I'm about to send a packet out. My agent and I are going to get together soon and figure out what I've written about it, freelance stuff about the subject, and we hope to find a publisher soon.
I'm kind of curious, I mean, it's none of my business, but I am sort of curious, when you write a book about Ed Sullivan or the comedians, which has a certain audience core of however many thousand people who would want to go out and read it and buy it, and yet you have to work 3 or 4 years on it to make the book right and do the research. Is that how do you make a living?
Well, you get in advance.
Right.
The real answer is investments. It has nothing to do with, you know, it's very hard to make a living in book publishing, or certainly in freelance writing now, because that has kind of dried up. So and I never could really do very well freelance writing because, you know, magazines are folding and they're changing and editors changing. It's a nightmare. So I never went that direction. I really went from newspapers right to books, and books are still around and they're still popular, and there's still, you know, bookstores, and even though the little ones are closing, there's still big ones, and there's still online, Amazon, and so on. So,
but without being John Grisham, you're able still to do a book every, say, 4 years,
something like that,
and feed yourself.
Help from the, you know, the money I got from my buyout and, you know, my personal investments and all that. But it would have been hard if I just tried to exist just purely on the advance, unless you really hit it big, like you say, Grisham or Dan Brown or somebody. It's tough, but it's the best thing left, and I still enjoy it. The only problem with it is you have to wait 4 or 5 years to see the thing happen. And I was very spoiled, you know, from writing on newspapers for most of my career, of having my name in print and having what I wrote in print every 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, you know, 15 hours after you write something,
you get addicted to that, and that was hard. That was hard to give up.
But then again, you have this column that you do every once in a while on The Columnists,
right.
And
so
there you have it.
Right, that feeds that part of me in a way.
So read him at thecolumnists.com. Buy his 3 books, including Raised on Radio, Seriously Funny, and, of course, the new one right here on our stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. Gerald Nachman, great, absolute pleasure to talk to you about all these things.
Well, thank you for having me on, David. It's been great fun talking to you, and you're very well informed, and you've obviously read the books, and two of them anyway, and I've enjoyed it.
$15 an issue sounds like a lot to spend for a theater magazine, but what if every issue were jam-packed with information, like what shows are Broadway bound, what big stars are in town, and what shows on and off Broadway are worth seeing? What if there were calendars for dance, opera, and cabaret? What if every issue had more theater information than the New York Times, Variety, and the Hollywood Reporter put together? $15 sounds reasonable, right? But guess what? A full year of Performing Arts Insider costs less, and Dave's Gone By listeners get an extra 10% off the subscription price, meaning you pay just $12 an issue for all the listings, rumors, reviews. Call 516-295-1511, 516-295-1511, and ask about the theater magazine the professionals use and theatergoers love, Performing Arts Insider.
You young rebels, and list while I sing. For the love of one's country is a terrible thing. It banishes fear with the speed of a flame, and it makes us all part Patriot game. My name is O'Hanlon, and I'm just gone 16. My home is in Monaghan, where I was weaned. I've learned all my life cruel England. And so I'm a part of the Patriot game. It's barely 2 years since I wandered away with a local battalion of the bold IRA. I'd read about heroes, and I wanted the same, to play up my part in the Patriot game.
This island of ours has for long been half free. 6 counties are under John Bull's tyranny. So I gave up my boyhood to drill and to train, to play my own part in the patriot game. And now as I lie here, my body all holds, I think of those traitors who bargained and sold. I wish that my rifle had given the same to those quislings who sold out the patriot game.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. That voice that you heard, that you just heard, was not only a very beautiful thing, but also the sound of the end of an era. Singing the Patriot Game there was Liam Clancy, the very last of the Clancy brothers, to my mind the greatest Irish popular folk group around. I know the Chieftains may get all the glory and the Pogues get all the hip street credit, but it was Tom Clancy and Paddy Clancy and Liam Clancy and Tommy Makem, of course, who really brought popular Irish music to the fore, certainly in the States. In an interview with the Daily News' David Hinckley, radio host Adrian Flannelly was doing a tribute to Liam Clancy, who died just a couple of days ago. And he said, the thing about the Clancy brothers was that when they started, even in Ireland, traditional Irish ballads were very somber affairs. You know, they were designed, quote, to send everyone into a depression. But it was the Clancys who swept out the cobwebs, and they rocked things up, well, pre-rock and roll, and then through the rock and roll era. And they made things more rollicking and fun and lively, and there was a machismo and a swagger, but also a gentility and a beauty. In that article from Hinckley in the Daily News, he mentions, for example, their version of the Wild Colonial Boy. Well, that, I had no idea, was originally a waltz. I mean, you can sort of hear them doing, or somebody doing that, in a 3/4 time if you really wanted to, I guess. It's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But the Clancy's making it into a rollicking story song in 4/4 time. And so, as Flannelly put it, the Wild Colonial Boy doesn't waltz, he moves.
There was a wild colonial boy, gentlemen, was his name. He was born and raised in Ireland, in a place called Castlemaine. He was his father's only son, his mother's pride and joy.
But it was Liam who was the Clancy brothers' great balladeer. And it's funny, because for years and years I was confused. I always thought Tommy Makem did all the ballads and the sweet voice. But no, Makem had that gravelly, crocodile-y voice. And Tom Clancy had this barrel-chested, macho, high-drinking voice. He almost became a parody of himself after a while, because every single line Tom Clancy would sing would begin with, "Hup! Hut the year, hut the, you know, like he was hiking a football. But, you know, together they worked amazingly well, and Paddy Clancy's voice was even deeper than Tommy Makem's. But Liam, everyone can swoon over people like, I don't know, Michael Bublé and Johnny Mathis and Harry Connick Jr., but Liam's gift was right up there. It was very beautiful and very pure and simple. It was touching something extremely simple but deep. As a matter of fact, when you go on the website or anywhere, you can't come across an obituary now for Liam Clancy without reading the line that Bob Dylan said about him, calling him the greatest ballad singer ever. And of course, the Bob Dylan connection is very strong. He and Liam Clancy were friends during those Greenwich Village years in the early 1960s. And when I played the Patriot Game to open the segment, we kind of now know that song even better because Dylan adapted it rather freely to create "When With God on Our Side." But Liam, which I never realized was actually short for William, Liam Clancy was born in Tipperary, Ireland in 1935, and he started in the family business. He was an insurance salesman, but he was a good-looking young fella, and he got into acting, and then started concertizing with his brothers. And I didn't even realize this. Wikipedia is a font of information, but he was sort of involved with one of the Guggenheim clan, and he followed that girl out to America, although she turned out to be more infatuated with him than the other way around, and she was a little bit crazy too. That didn't work out, but the music did. And here's something, the most serendipitous thing of this entire show, and I love when this happens, because we have planned the interview with Gerald Nachman, author of the Ed Sullivan book, a couple of weeks ago. And when did the Clancys make it big in America? Well, it was thanks to the Ed Sullivan Show. They were on, they got like 14 minutes in a segment, which was unheard of on Sullivan, as Nachman told us. Most people said they were going to get 10 minutes, and they got 5. So a writer for Time magazine at the time said that the appearance on Ed Sullivan and the Clancys doing the clubs at that time said they catapulted Irish folk music into the mainstream. They were signed by Columbia Records, of course, and made a string of wonderful, wonderful albums up till 1970, 1971. Did a couple more underrated albums for some other labels, like the Audio Fidelity. I still have those records and haven't heard them in years because I don't have a turntable. And check out 1995's Older But No Wiser disc from Vanguard, which has Liam and Patty and Bobby Clancy doing their thing. It's really a neat album. And, you know, I've said this on the air before. I'm not going to do the whole big spiel, but the scandal of Columbia Records' handling of the back catalog of the Clancy brothers. I usually do this spiel around St. Patrick's Day, but every couple of years, Columbia Legacy, that imprint that they have, will do another compilation of Clancy Brothers recordings. Usually it's a mishmash of some hits and things that we all know if we grew up loving their music, and some rarities that they'll throw in there, and they'll call it best of, even though it really isn't sort of the best of. Meanwhile, more than half their original catalog, those great Columbia records, which were often produced by Teo Macero, who worked with Bob Dylan, for gosh sakes. They were beautifully done. And some of the live albums, Live in Ireland, which is one of their best records, never been released on disc. Now, I don't know. I haven't checked Rhapsody. I haven't checked some of the websites. Maybe now, eventually, everything's going to come out and be available everywhere, so long as it's online and record companies don't have to go through the expense of releasing discs of everything anymore. But really, I mean, except for the Carnegie Hall album, the Fairly Late Christmas album, Hardy and Hellish, and all the compilations, Columbia has just sat on this stuff for 30 or 40 years, marvelous records like Flowers in the Valley and Songs Sing of the Sea, which are two of my favorites. And why? Don't tell me there's not an audience for this music, because anytime Patty Maloney farts, someone releases another Chieftains record. So please, Columbia, I say this every couple of years, go in there. Go cobble these together, or if you want to, do a box set for St. Patrick's Day. You know, do a 6-CD set. You can pretty much fit every major recording that the Clancys did for Columbia on that, along with maybe a couple of rarities even. And just get it out there. So, you know, already one generation has missed it since the 60s and 70s when they were doing their thing. Don't let another generation go without hearing some of this beautiful, exciting music. Most of all, I want to hear a song I've only been able to listen to on cassette. Liam Clancy did the most beautiful version of Gordon Lightfoot song, In the Early Morning Rain. Lots of people have done it. Dylan has done it. Not a very good version, I think, on his Dylan album, or maybe Self Portrait. But Lightfoot does a perfectly nice version of his own song. But Liam, he has the beautiful, just the gentle, simple voice to do it. Can you hear it? No, can't find it on YouTube, can't find it anywhere unless you've got it in your record collection. If you do have a Clancy collection, go dig out that album, because it's so worth hearing that version of that song. Anyway, to finishing the Clancy Brothers story, after they broke up in the early 1970s, Liam and Tommy Makem stayed together and became a duo, touring and doing albums for well over a decade. And there were different permutations of the Clancy Brothers that would get back together now and again. Liam still sang and toured till the very end of his life, even though he was quite sick. He had a lung disease that, in fact, also killed brother Bobby Clancy, who joined the Clancy Brothers kind of late in their run. And the nice thing is that Liam had a pretty good life. He sang what he wanted to, went around touring. He also had a home recording studio in Ring, Ireland, which is where he was buried just a couple of days ago. And I guess for me, the death of Liam Clancy is more than just the death of a musician. There is another piece of childhood there that goes, because my dad got me into the Clancy Brothers. He used to play their records over and over again and got me into playing them again as a grown-up. And, of course, when you're a kid, you realize that the songs are pretty, the songs are fun, but they get deeper on some level as you grow older, and you realize the beauty and the simplicity of what they were doing, and especially how much beauty that Liam and his voice brought to the Clancy Brothers. It's the voice you hear when we played the Patriot game, or The Parting Glass, which is the song that they would end most of their concerts with, and certainly the concerts that my parents and I saw when we saw them in New York a couple of times. Or it's a voice you'll hear in the song that closes this segment of Dave's Gone By, Farewell, Liam Clancy.
We made a pay and sing all the way, my laddie-o. And the owners say that she's had her day. And sing all the way, my laddie-o. So heave away for the final trawl and sing all away, my laddie-o. It's an easy pull, for the catch is small, and sing all away, my laddie-o. Then stow your gear, lads, and batten down and sing all away, my laddie-o. And I'll take the wheel, lads, and turn around and sing all away, my laddie-o. And I'll join the venture and the morning star and sing all away, my laddie-o. Riding high and empty towards the bar and sing all away, my laddie-o. Now I'd rather beach her on the Skerries Rock and sing all away, my laddie-o. And to see her torched in the breaker's dawn
If you're like me, you agree that television could always be a little more Jewish. Well, our prayers are answered. Rabbi Sal Solomon, that's me, hosts Shalom Dammit. I do Bible studies, sermons, pap smears, whatever I damn well want. See all the episodes anytime on YouTube.com. Shalom Dammit, it's Jewish and it's proud! Sponsor me, Dave's gone by. Run your ad, folks will buy. If you want to reach the public, sponsor me. Advertise on this program for incredibly reasonable rates with long-term discounts. See prices at davesgoneby.org. Sponsor me. If you're wise on Dave's gone by, you'll advertise. If you want to be successful, sponsor me.
This is Gerald Nachman, the author of Right Here on Our Stage Tonight at Sullivan's America, and I'm very happy to be here on Dave's Gone By on davesgoneby.org.
Dave's Gone By.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Our eine kleine time has been fine, but time for us to go, alas. But first, got to tell you a bunch of things. First of all, of course, our sponsors. Thank you very much to Hewlett Minuteman Press, the copy kings of Broadway. Call 516-569-5577, 516-569-5577. And remember, you go to Hewlett Minuteman Press and you get 10% off if you tell them Dave sent you. Program's also brought to you by Performing Arts Insider, the Bible of Broadway. Go to performingartsinsider.com to find out all about this journal that is now 67 years old, telling you everything you need to know about what's going on the stages of New York. Programs also brought to you by TotalTheater.com, where you can read over 2,500 theater reviews and I think about 350 feature stories, all about shows not only in New York, but across the country and around the world. TotalTheater.com. And thank you, of course, to Jeff, as always, at Fancy Schmancy Balloons, 516-797-3229. Balloons and centerpieces to make your party special, shouldn't your event be a fancy schmancy one. And remember, everybody, check out davesgoneby.org, the website for this program. We've got photos there, information about upcoming shows, and virtually every show we've ever done, apart from maybe two or three, they're in the archives. You can hear them anytime for free. You can download them to your iPod or just stream them right there on your computer. It's all at davesgoneby.org. Give a listen. And give a watch, or however you would put that, to Shalom Dammit, Rabbi Sal Solomon's Peace, Love, and Acid Reflux Hour. The 10 episodes that he did are still on YouTube.com. They're kind of cut up because you can only do short segments on there, but they're all there. So check them out. Shalom Dammit. Well, thank you, of course. Everybody get Gerald Nachman's book right here on our stage tonight, Ed Sullivan's America. It's from University of California Press. And if reading through that is any indication, you should also get his other books, Seriously Funny and Raised on Radio. Thank you so much to Gerald for being in the neighborhood today. Want to give a couple of quick shout-outs and remind everybody that Martin Vidnovic is going to be doing four nights at the Metropolitan Room somewhere between December 16th and the 29th. Go to metropolitanroom.com to find out exactly when. Uwe Lemper is at Joe's Pub on December, 10th, 13th, 20th, 21st, 27th, and 28th. And Issa, a.k.a. James Sibbery, is at Joe's Pub December 11th and 12th. Carrie Hoffman is doing My Sinatra at the Algonquin Theater on East 24th Street. Not the Algonquin Oak Room. This is the the Algonquin Theater, and he's doing that December 13th and 14th, and a couple of dates later in December, and I think January too. So check that out. Also, last chance to catch Theodore Bekele in Sholom Aleichem, Laughter Through Tears at the Baruch Performing Arts Center through this weekend. Thank you, as always, to my good friend Jeff Goodman. I think he's back from Vegas or Thailand or Singapore or somewhere. Never quite sure where he is in the world. I know where my mom and dad are. They're back in Long Island, and I wish them love and all good things, as well to my in-laws, Mama and Papa Weil, and only wonderful, beautiful, happy things for my beloved wife, Joyce. Well, time to leave the neighborhood, but I'll be back in a week or two with a 323rd episode of Dave's Gone By. So until then, don't miss your days going by. This is Dave Lefkowitz wishing you good night. I hope you're not having to plow out from a really big snow. And gone by.
Ed Sullivan. Me, Harry McAfee, appearing with Ed Sullivan. Ed. Ed Sullivan. Ed. Ed Sullivan.
As we